I had a conversation that made me realize that, like, most people don't have chronic pain. I clearly didn't have an autoimmune disorder, so the only explanation left was just anxiety.
Genetics isn't always black and white, and the emotions and decisions surrounding genetic testing can be even more complex. Welcome to Patient Stories with Gray Genetics. I'm Eleanor Griffith, a certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, a telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service. It seems like there are constantly headlines in the news about genetics, but few news stories focus on the patient experience. At Gray Genetics, we are collecting patient stories, your stories. Every other Tuesday, we share an interview with a patient or a genetic counselor.
I think the way that the medical system tends to be sort of segmented meant that there wasn't much of a big picture view happening.
Mary Crawford is a junior at St. Olaf College majoring in music and religion. She was also recently diagnosed with the hypermobile type of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or EDS, after a long diagnostic odyssey. Her experience has made her passionate about EDS and the difficulties individuals with EDS encounter in seeking a diagnosis and treatment within the healthcare system. Mary, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you were recently diagnosed with a hypermobile type of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. What does that diagnosis mean for you, and how did you eventually receive that diagnosis? I believe it was a long process for you.
Yeah. So EDS is a genetic connective tissue disorder. So it's realistically, it's a group of disorders. So they're typically thought of as primarily affecting the skin and joints and sort of soft tissues. But realistically, they affect the entire body. So the hypermobile type is the most common of the subtypes and can be, I think, particularly difficult to diagnose in some ways. So for me, I sort of had symptoms my whole life, but they were always pretty vague. So things like, you know, joint pain, stomach problems, that were impactful, but didn't really have something specific enough that doctors could easily point out what was wrong.
Is it symptoms that you would bring up when you were at a doctor's appointment, or it didn't even seem like something concrete enough to try to seek attention for?
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. I think my parents remember that when I was a kid, I would sometimes just like lay on the floor and say, like, I don't feel good. And I know that I had a lot of joint pain, which I think I did bring up to my pediatrician. And I think it was just seen as growing pain, which I think is pretty common. I know I was tested pretty extensively for like various GI disorders. I've been tested for celiac a bunch of times. Don't have it, luckily. But it's always just little things that sort of popped up and we would bring up, and oftentimes we would test and nothing would show up. So it was just assumed that I would eventually grow out of those problems.
And how old were you when all of this was going on? Like when this started, like when you were really little, like 6, or is it more like 12?
This probably started when I was like 6 or so. I think then when I was 14, I had a conversation that made me realize that like most people don't have chronic pain, which is bizarre looking back, but I think it's just, you know, in some ways I think I'm lucky because I never had like an onset of pain, so I don't have much to compare to. But it meant that I just genuinely didn't realize that could mean something. And so then after that, I would say there was sort of another phase in my diagnostic journey where we were really looking at various rheumatologic disorders, which I'm really glad was looked into, but just didn't happen to be the answer. And then I want to say in the past 2 years or so, I sort of started doing a lot of research. I realized that something was clearly not right, and that I think the way that the medical system tends to be sort of segmented meant that there wasn't much of a big picture view happening. So I had the resources and interest to sort of research and look into what was happening. And actually, at first, when I first came across EDS, I was kind of annoyed because it kept popping up. And I was like, well, it's too rare. There's no, you know, I don't have it. I don't dislocate joints every single day. You know, clearly, this is just some weird, like, error in my research.
And your research, are you Googling things, basically?
Yeah, as well as I have, like, institutional access to lots of medical journals through my college. So I was, you know, looking through there, which was helpful, but I was reading more studies than overviews.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then I think one night I was basically annoyed that EDS kept popping up and trying to prove that I didn't have it. And so the way that it's diagnosed is through sort of a clinical checklist rather mm-hmm. than a genetic test. And so I came across that and I went through it to prove to myself that there was no way I had EDS. And I passed pretty pretty clearly.
Easily, yeah.
And so that's when I started bringing it up to doctors. I had a little bit of difficulty. The first geneticist I saw seemed kind of rushed and didn't really get my medical history correct or represent my symptoms accurately. Mm-hmm. So I got a second opinion and was diagnosed.
So, and were you self-referred to the two geneticists that you saw, or did you have still your pediatrician from home or a doctor you were seeing closer to your college that referred you to genetics? Or how did you get those appointments?
Yeah, so I was, I brought it up to my doctor at school, and she, you know, looked into genetics clinics nearby. And this was sort of where there was another problem, which is that obviously EDS is congenital, so everybody has it from the time they're born, but it's not always diagnosed in childhood. So at least the genetics clinics around me, the adult clinics really only accepted cancer patients, and the pediatric clinics didn't accept adults.
Oh, that's interesting, because I mean, the pediatric clinic is where kind of the least bad place for most adults looking for a genetic diagnosis to show up, but I hadn't considered that they might not even accept adults. I know, or I have the sense that a lot of geneticists, you know, there's a lot of referrals, there's a long wait, and there's some frustration around EDS referrals just because they are complex patients with complex medical histories and vague symptoms, and then a lot of people coming in looking for genetic testing that I know you know isn't available.
Right.
So there can be like a lot of time, and then a patient's pretty dissatisfied at the end.
Yeah, and I almost wonder if, and I have no idea from the, like, you know, genetics professional side of things, if, like, maybe EDS patients would be accepted into pediatric clinics more readily if it was the sort of thing that could be, like, you know, they could order a test and see, which is certainly possible for some kinds of EDS, but most patients won't have that experience.
Right.
Yeah.
And with the first medical geneticist you said, how did you even realize that they got some of your medical history wrong? Did you get like a consult note or a follow-up where it wasn't accurately summarized?
Yeah. So I sort of left the appointment thinking like, well, that felt a little bit weird, but it was okay. And then I got the notes and I was just looking through and I was like, well, that's not quite true. And so I spoke to the clinic and it seemed as though there just wasn't really a way for them to like go back into the notes and change it.
Seriously?
Yeah, or at least they didn't have a setup to do that.
Yeah. Did you, when you met with the medical geneticist, was there also a genetic counselor working with them who you spoke with and helped take your history, or was it just you and a medical geneticist?
Yeah, so I saw a genetic counselor beforehand who was amazing. My dad has 12 siblings, so we spent a lot of time taking family history. I think probably it was a shorter appointment than normal just because there wasn't a lot of conversation about, like, you know, we didn't have to talk about, like, variants of unknown significance or, like, what different results might mean. So then I saw the geneticist, and then that was it.
Was that the same day, like, they worked together? The genetic counselor referred you to the geneticist?
Yeah, that was the same day.
Okay, I'm just very interested in the dysfunction.
Yeah.
How did you get to another geneticist? Did you just self-refer or call around?
Yeah, so actually this is one of the reasons I'm so thankful for patient advocates. The Ehlers-Danlos Society has a list of EDS knowledgeable medical professionals sort of organized by location. And so I was able to look through that, find a doctor who is an expert in EDS like an hour away. And then I was able to see her within a couple months. It was pretty remarkable.
Which is quick for a genetics appointment.
Yeah.
Wait time. And your experience there was much better, it sounds like.
It was, yeah. She was just super comprehensive, gave me, you know, sort of all the other referrals I would need, which was good after a not so great first experience.
Yeah. Did she also work with a genetic counselor, or was it just the geneticist?
It was just her.
Okay. Were you surprised that there was no genetic testing related to EDS, or it sounds like you'd done so much reading on your own, like you basically self-diagnosed with a checklist, so that wasn't a disappointment to you in the appointment as it is, I think, to some people?
Yeah. I think it was a surprise to me when I first found out there wasn't a genetic test for EDS, because I just remember in like high school biology, you know, the genetic disorders that we would talk about were typically recessive and caught on like birth screenings. And so I think I just had this idea in my mind that, you know, with most kinds of medicine, testing is sort of imprecise and you're really working off of signs and then correlating that with things that are associated with particular diagnoses, but that genetics was an exception to that and that there was pretty much always just a simple blood test you can run, which I think it's pretty remarkable that.
Yeah, it's a problem with how genetics is taught at the high school level.
Yeah. I think
it should probably start with multifactorial genetics and then say also there are a few conditions inherited in this way. Now do some Punnett squares.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's really convenient for Punnett squares, but then I think it might represent all of genetics very well.
We'll be back with patient stories in just a minute.
Have you ever wondered how your own family medical history might impact your personal health risks? Or maybe you're wondering if you'd be a good candidate for genetic testing, but you aren't quite ready to commit to a full genetic counseling session. Our Family History Review is perfect for those seeking more information and guidance before making an appointment with a genetic counselor. Simply answer a few questions about your personal and family medical history, and a certified genetic counselor will review it and return a written evaluation right to your email inbox in 3 to 5 business days. They will also provide you with a personalized risk assessment and even recommend to you what your next steps could be. Check out this service and more on greygenetics.com. That's GREYgenetics.com.
Has having that diagnosis changed your medical care or lifestyle choices or improved your symptoms or your pain?
Yeah, I think for me, the main difference has been just the way that doctors sort of treat me and investigate other issues. Because without sort of an overlying diagnosis, I think the assumption was just that, like, you know, I clearly didn't have an autoimmune disorder. So the only explanation left was just anxiety. And since having a diagnosis, I think doctors are more willing to put in a referral to really dig a little deeper, because EDS is so complex and does have impact really on every system in the body. And I think the specific diagnoses that they look into changes a bit, because there are some pretty common comorbid disorders.
Is there anything specifically that's happened for you since you were diagnosed about 2 years ago?
It was actually just this year in March or April.
Any specific specialists you've seen, or like have you seen a physical therapist?
Yeah. So I am seeing a physical therapist, which has been wonderful. Physical therapy is really one of the best, both like preventative and sort of treatment options for EDS. Mm-hmm. So that's basically, you know, trying to help me figure out how to do the least damage to my body possible. And then I see a cardiologist. It's pretty common in EDS to have a form of dysautonomia called POTS, so postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So that, after being diagnosed with EDS, within a couple of months I had that diagnosis, because I mean, some of it was just the timing happened to work out. But also just that then I really fit into that clinical picture of POTS with the EDS diagnosis.
Do you think that seeing that geneticist who made the diagnosis for you, do you think that was an important first step to get the diagnosis? Or does it seem like a different specialist type, like even a physical therapist could have been as well or better positioned to give you the diagnosis or the help that you need?
Yeah. So this is actually, it's one of the things that's interesting about EDS is that, or at least the hypermobile type, I'm not sure this is true for all types of EDS. But within the like international diagnostic criteria, it actually includes that any doctor can make the diagnosis as long as they feel comfortable doing so. Which I think was done specifically to increase the rate at which patients can be diagnosed, because it seems to be pretty significantly underdiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think the problem is that doctors in other specialties don't always see a diagnosis from like a non-geneticist as being a real diagnosis, even though it is in really all official capacities.
Yeah. So like just the fact that with doctors, you can say, I have a diagnosis of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and it was made by a geneticist kind of gives more credibility to what you're talking about when you have symptoms come up or talking to doctors.
Right.
A lot of the time now when I talk to people, they end up telling me that they've connected with people with a similar diagnosis online.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done any of that? Like, have you made connections with people within the Ehlers-Danlos community, or are you on like message boards or social media? Has that been meaningful for you?
Yeah, I mean, it has in some ways, I think. So I went to the conference this summer, which was virtual, and they had nice like groups of people who are dealing with like similar things or like who are students with EDS. So that was really nice. I haven't really had enough sustained like connection, but that's really been my schedule thing. But there are lots of opportunities. I know the EDS Society runs a number of like Zoom calls with, you know, patients of various groupings. Yeah, there's certainly opportunities for that.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's not something where for some people with certain diagnoses, they like are really like longing to connect with people who've had similar experiences. And it sounds like for you, that's wasn't necessarily something you're specifically looking for. You're just glad to finally have a diagnosis.
Yeah. Yeah. And weirdly, I've actually found that there are several people just in my personal life who have been diagnosed with or in the process of being diagnosed with EDS. So I also have that interesting situation, which I have, I think, more in-person support than most people do.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Has your diagnosis, you were just diagnosed, you said March or April of this year?
Yeah.
Right when the pandemic was kind of gearing up. So, I mean, has that diagnosis changed your day-to-day life or activity so far, like based on recommendations from the physical therapist? Are there things that you do differently? Are there like high-impact sports that you were involved in that you've given up, or just day-to-day little things that you've changed?
Yeah, there's certainly so I'm a music student and I play oboe, which is in some ways great on the joints and is in other ways.
Is it hard on the fingers, like the repetitive fast movements?
Yeah, and especially the thumb, since you sort of have to rest your whole instrument there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely sort of things I've had to do with my posture. I have to play sitting down, which is a little bit odd. And I use a neck strap to try to take some pressure off there. Luckily, I wasn't involved in any high-impact sports, which I think I would probably have much more severe joint problems if I did, just because obviously they're high-impact. So mostly the changes have been in just understanding that, like, you know, it's not just that I'm oversensitive, that there's actually something going on in my body that most people are not dealing with. And so it feels like it's given me, like, permission to give myself space to actually rest and take care of myself in ways that I think I hadn't really felt were as necessary or allowed before I had a diagnosis, even though I obviously had the same symptoms.
Is part of that, I wonder how much of that's for yourself, like your self-acceptance and giving yourself permission to rest, and how much of that is explaining to other people, like, I need to stand, I need to sit, I need to change my posture, and you have a diagnosis to give to explain it.
Yeah, I think it's honestly, it's a little bit of both. I think having the, you know, I can certainly accept it for myself and say, like, okay, you know, my friend might not need to rest, but we don't have the same bodies, and, you know, I can take the time anyway. But I think also then having that, like, knowledge of, like, yeah, if somebody asks why I need to rest, I can give them an answer that will make sense. Which I think speaks to the way that we sort of expect that every medical problem has to have a diagnosis, or else it's not, it doesn't really exist. Which I think is such a damaging thing for undiagnosed people.
Yeah. Is there anything looking back that you think would have been really different for you if you'd gotten a diagnosis earlier? Are there certain times when you see that if a doctor had taken a little more time, you might have gotten a diagnosis earlier too?
Yeah, I think there were several times when, you know, even doctors would just notice little things. Like, they'd be like, oh, your skin is really soft. Like, what lotion do you use? And that is part of EDS. And I just wonder if doctors had more awareness and if they thought of it as not necessarily being ultra rare, which is, I think, the impression that a lot of doctors have, is that this is this kind of interesting disorder that you learn about for an hour in med school and expect to never see in your practice, that I feel like leads to doctors oftentimes just missing signs and not really considering it as a potential diagnosis.
Yeah. Do you know, I don't know offhand, what the estimated prevalence is of the hypermobile type specifically, which is the most common type?
Yeah. So this is sort of an interesting thing. I was actually just reading about this morning, because I had heard that the estimated prevalence is somewhere between 1 in 5,000 and 1 in 2,000. And apparently the 1 in 5,000 number was just something that somebody put in a medical textbook once and doesn't really have a clear source.
That's the story of so many things in genetics.
So interesting.
Yeah, that's so unsurprising. Yeah. And then, of course, if something's diagnosed, you know, then, you know, you have an estimated lower prevalence and it's real, which can lead to, you know, continued underdiagnosis and underestimating what the real prevalence is.
Yeah. And I think it's starting to, they did like a study of medical records in Wales a couple of years ago and found that it was actually probably closer to like 1 in 500, which is a pretty big difference.
Yeah, big jump.
Yeah. But as far as I'm aware, I think there's estimates, but not necessarily like a real solid, like, evidence-based guess.
Yeah, which is also typical in genetics.
Yeah.
Do you have any family history of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome? Like, looking back or in retrospect or talking to other family members, anyone else who's had similar experiences where it kind of makes sense?
I'm a little bit odd because we can't quite tell if I have a family history of it or not. Mm-hmm. And that's partially because it seems as though for whatever reason, men are just not typically as severely impacted as women. And so we think, looking at my dad's side of the family, it seems like a lot of people have, you know, soft and stretchy skin and lots of hypermobile joints. But as far as I'm aware, nobody has been diagnosed yet. But then also because it would then come through my dad, it's a little bit...
Yeah, maybe less likely to actually see it if it affects women more in terms of this, the symptoms and the presentation.
Yeah.
What would you say to someone who thinks that they might have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome? Like, would you encourage them to reach out to a geneticist, or how would you encourage them to go about trying to get a diagnosis if they think that's something that would also be helpful to them? It sounds like that resource list on the EDS website was helpful to you.
Yeah. So that I would definitely recommend that resource list. I would also say, like, one of the things that was most helpful to me was doing a lot of research, because oftentimes the doctors I would meet with were just sort of misinformed or looking for the wrong things in EDS. Mm-hmm. So I had a particular picture of what EDS looks like that certainly some people do fit that clinical picture, but as with most things, there's a lot of variation and not everyone will look like that, you know, archetypal patient.
Right.
So actually, I think for patients, having the understanding that, like, sometimes your doctor might just be wrong and you might know something that they don't, and that, you know, it's okay to bring in research and
advocate for yourself.
Yeah, definitely lots of advocacy. Yeah, and also just to not be afraid to get a second opinion. I think when patients bring up a diagnosis, there's often sort of hesitancy to advocate because it can be difficult being in that position of, like, well, you know, I've never been to med school, I'm not an expert, you know, I feel like my research methods are decent, but, you know, there's always going to be that power imbalance. But I think just recognizing that it's okay, you know, your responsibility is to yourself and your care, and it's okay for people to be wrong, even if that person is a doctor, and that, mm-hmm. you know, you always have a right to a second or third opinion if you feel like something was missed or not quite understood correctly.
Yeah. Did you fill out pretty detailed intake forms before you saw the geneticist you saw?
Yeah. So I think they basically sent my entire medical record, which, you know, all I had to do was contact a bunch of departments and get them sent over. And then I did, like, a huge family tree, which...
You had to do that before the appointment.
Yeah. And then we went over it during the appointment. It was difficult to try to, like, figure out, like, everything that has ever happened medically with, you know, all my aunts and uncles and cousins.
Right. And so it's like, we try to get family history, but a lot of the time, you know, it's going to be wrong or people have no idea. Like, there's no way you can know all these things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering if you think it would be helpful to, for someone to write out their specific symptoms and history sort of in an organized way to avoid the errors that you saw with the first geneticist. Cause I feel like most genetic consults types, like, there's some sort of intake form that someone fills out in advance, mm-hmm. but they're not usually tailored to something like EDS where there's so many different symptoms
yeah.
and issues that have come up. And it's like, well, this happened in this year, and then this happened, and then this happened somewhere between here. Like, it's a lot of detailed information. I wonder if that would help people get more accurate diagnoses or more patient geneticists if they kind of came in with that, those things kind of already documented, instead of waiting till they get a consult note and being like, so this part's wrong, this part's wrong, this part's wrong.
Yeah. So actually, that's interesting that you say that, because I did do that with the second appointment. And I just totally forgot until you brought it up that, yeah, actually having that list of, like, okay, you know, I, like, you know, had such and such happen in 2008. Was just, like, I think helpful for myself both to recognize that, like, oh yeah, these things happened, I shouldn't forget to say that, but also then to actually be able to, like, pass something to the doctor and say, like, look, here's what's happened throughout my life. You know, here's what that looked like. I think helped connect the dots.
Yeah, I know one of the few patients I've seen for an EDS possible diagnosis type with like other things going on, I was like, well, the most maybe I can do for you, we did order some testing for her because she really wanted some, which was negative, which was unsurprising.
Yeah.
But, you know, she was just like frustrated with, you know, like different chronic pain issues, some things that definitely didn't fit into EDS. But I was like, well, I'm going to, you know, write this all out in a consult note and like tell me, you know, if there's errors and, you know, you should see a neurologist for these reasons. And it's like, it could help if this is accurate, if you give it to them, because you just have so many different things going on.
Yeah.
You know, and it's when a doctor's trying to get a quick history, it's not really possible.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think especially because there's no start date. Like I feel like I get asked at every appointment, like, when did this start? And I'm like, well, that
part. Right. It's the first thing they want to write down. And then like, well, not sure. Moving on.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else should I be asking you about, or what else would you like people or doctors to know? And we do have, there's always a lot of genetic counselors who listen to this episode too.
Yeah.
So if you have anything specifically that you think genetic counselors should keep in mind as they're talking to patients who may have EDS.
I think one of the things for, I guess, just medical professionals in general, sort of regardless of type, is just to think of EDS as a possibility. I think oftentimes it's just not even on the radar. And I think that's changing, but I think probably patient experiences would be a lot better. I think there would be much shorter diagnostic delays if people were looking at sort of this particular constellation of, you know, hypermobility and pain and, you know, sort of GI issues and weird dizziness, and seeing actually a connected group of symptoms rather than just some weird things happening.
Yeah. And you kind of went into this before, but I think sometimes there's a perception that the diagnosis isn't that helpful.
Yeah.
But you've really found that it is helpful for doctors to take you seriously and then to get related diagnoses, right?
Yeah. I think there's a perception, I mean, in some ways it's accurate, that because there is no specific pharmaceutical option for EDS, that it doesn't matter whether somebody has a diagnosis of EDS or if they're just, you know, seeing a physical therapist for hypermobility. And well, I think that's true from a physical therapy standpoint, that the treatment doesn't change that much. It changes a lot in the way that I think doctors think of you and think of the possibilities to investigate in terms of other issues.
Patient Stories is an ad-free podcast and is unaffiliated with any commercial genetic testing laboratories. We would like to keep it that way. You can now donate to Patient Stories online by going to graygenetics.com/podcast/donate. If you don't want to make a monetary donation but still want to support the show in another way, leaving a review on iTunes or sharing our episodes through social media also makes a big difference.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendations.